When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. With Vanta, you can automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more. Vanta's market-leading trust management platform can help you unify security program management with a built-in risk register and reporting, and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 fast-growing companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. You can watch Vanta's on-demand video at vanta.com/decoder to learn more. That's vanta.com/decoder.
Support for this podcast comes from another podcast. The world's most valuable resource, it's actually data. Our data, based on our behaviors, is frequently being gathered, tracked, stored, and sold. So what does this mean for us? Join host Rafi Krikorian for season 2 of Technically Optimistic, where he'll take you on a deep dive into how our data is being used and what we can do about it. From social media feeds to foundational human rights, Krikorian leads us into territories both familiar and unexpected with openness and genuine curiosity. New episodes of Technically Optimistic drop every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Decoder. I'm Hank Green. I'm a science guy. I help run an educational media company called Complexly, and I'm also a big fan of this podcast. I am not, however, the editor-in-chief of The Verge, but Nilay Patel is, and Decoder is Nilay's show about big ideas and other problems. One of those problems is that one of the best possible guests for Decoder is unfortunately also the host of Decoder. So while we get to hear a lot of Nilay's thoughts on a lot of this stuff, when I listen to this podcast, I often think, man, I would like to hear Nilay interviewed on his own podcast. And so I went on to Threads and I made that joke and Nilay responded, let's do it. And so now this is it. We are doing it. Nilay has got some weird ideas about the internet. For example, that he is going to revolutionize the media through blog posts. He keeps saying it, but what the hell does he mean? While I was busy building my business on other people's platforms, Nilay has built something very rare in the year 2024, a website that publishes content and isn't behind a paywall, yet still makes money. How does he do it? How does he make decisions? How is The Verge structured? The tables have turned. You'll also hear Nilay try to convince me that the Fediverse isn't just happening, but that it's also going to be important and that we should be paying attention to it and that it is going to make the internet better. And I think I maybe even got a Fediverse-related Verge scoop in here. One of the wildest moments of this conversation for me was when I made a comment that I thought was just like a universally believed truth about the post-platform internet, that people these days prefer individuals to brands. And then Nilay told me, no, that's wrong. It's not people who are doing that. It's the systems that deliver that content to people. A distinction that I'm going to be thinking about for a long, long time. He won't say it, of course, so I will. Nilay is a defining voice of this very bizarre moment in the history of media, and his leadership and strategy have proved that content can win, especially when you stop chasing every shiny object that platforms place in front of you and think instead about your audience first. All right, Nilay Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, let's do it. Nilay Patel, you are editor-in-chief of The Verge and co-founder of The Verge and co-host of The Vergecast and, of course, host of Decoder most days. But this one, Nilay, welcome to Decoder.
This is terrifying. I want to be very clear to the audience. I'm in peril. That's how this feels.
It's funny. When I first proposed this, you were like, this is amazing because it's so much harder to host than to be interviewed. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to have to do a bunch of work on this. Whereas when you interviewed me, I just like showed up. Now you're just showing up. Now you get to feel, though. You get to feel what it's like.
Literally my way into the studio, I thought to myself, how do I make decisions?
What's our org chart?
Yeah.
Well, get ready because those questions are coming. I'm super excited about this. It's very cool. It's very cool that we get to do this. You think a lot and have a lot of good ideas and talk to a lot of people about, I think, things that are very present suddenly, more present now than they have been. The internet, it feels like it's been tossed up into the air and we could see it all fall down and see where it lands a little bit. It's an election year. That's awful. I hate those. And there's just a lot of reasons to be thinking about the kinds of things you think about right now. So I'm really glad to get to talk to you. But let's start about you being the person who runs the last website on Earth. Because you say things all the time and then you don't explain them, which I love. But now I've got you. And so you have to explain to me why The Verge is, quote unquote, the last website on Earth.
That's a little bit of a joke. It's 50% a joke. I'm aware that there are other websites. What I specifically mean is we were founded in a boom time of websites. We were founded in 2011. We started talking about the site in 2010. We remain part of a venture-backed digital media startup. There were a lot of those back then. We had a lot of competition in 2011. Meaningful, like, we were scared of them competition. Read Write Web existed, and we like tried to beat them every day. TechCrunch was a very different kind of publication back then. We tried to beat them all the time, and I really respect the people I competed against. I came up at Engadget competing ferociously against the people at Gizmodo, and we became first rivals and then really good friends out of that competition. Some of those sites still exist. Some of them are still doing great work. Some of them still have great people. But that moment when there was a ferocious rush of energy and money and attention into websites has obviously faded, right? We're not making those the same way we used to anymore. And then I look at my peer group and so many of them are gone.
Yeah.
And that's – so that to me there's like a – it's that. It's all of the things that the people and the properties that I used to wake up in fear of – many of them are radically different than they used to be, and we're still here, and that feels strange to me.
It feels strange. It you won, and it's like, oh, I don't actually – like it turns out that when you're put into the arena and you're the last man standing, there's just like a lot of carnage around, which isn't that much of a triumph. It feels like it hurts a little bit. It's weird to be us, our age, and hear that the word website feels almost anachronistic. It feels of another era.
The way I think about it is that I don't have anyone else's algorithm to think about, and that is really important to me. But then I look at all of the most important creators and the most influential members of the new media, and what they are is so successful that they have transcended algorithms on other people's platforms. So I'll just point to Marques Brownlee, who I think is an amazing reviewer and great tech YouTuber. He has transcended the YouTube algorithm, and that has afforded him a kind of success that I think a lot of people are frankly jealous of. Sometimes I'm jealous of it. But I never think about YouTube, and I'm very happy with never really thinking about YouTube in that way. I think there's a tension there where that's what the website affords you. If you can build an audience for the website, but building an audience for a website is almost impossible.
Right. You have also said that you are going to revolutionize the media with blog posts. This is a similar sentence in that we are also referring to an anachronistic thing almost in the form of blog post, but we're going to move forward by moving backward a little bit somehow. What do you mean when you say that? I'm going to make you explain yourself.
I say we're going to revolutionize the media with blog posts all the time. That is a joke that we started making about our redesign on TheVerge.com, where we added these things called quick posts that just let us post more frequently. And it is all tied to that notion of just fighting back against the pressures of an algorithm.
The platform world.
Yeah, and the last platform on the web of any scale or influence is Google Search. Mm-hmm. And so over time, web pages have become dramatically optimized for Google Search. And that means the kinds of things people write about, the containers that we write in, are mostly designed to be optimized for Google Search. They're not designed for – I need to just quickly tell you about this and move on. And our little insight was, well, what if we just like don't do that? What if we only write for the people who come directly to our website instead of the people who find our articles through search or Google Discover or whatever other Google platforms are in the world? And so we just made these little blog posts. And the idea was if you just come to our website one more time a day because there's one more thing to look at that you'll like we will be fine. And I think if you look around the media landscape right now, we did that a year or so ago. More and more people are starting to realize, oh, we should just like make the websites more valuable. And the easiest way to make the websites more valuable is to have our talented people make more stories. And not just like more stories, but like have more – like openly have more fun on the website.
Right.
Business Insider is doing that. Semaphore is doing that in other ways. And that's what I mean is like, oh, if you start writing for other people, which is the heart of what a blog post really is, like it's you trying to entertain yourself and trying to entertain just a handful of other people, you're going to go really much farther than trying to satisfy the robot.
It does feel like there was a time, like when blog posts were first a thing, when it was very sort of like, I have a blog, this is me, and I have this relationship with my audience. And there was a lot of like, you know, there was snark and there was creativity. And I see this tossed in with stuff at The Verge today, that influence still sort of like comes through. It feels like, and like I struggle with this as a YouTuber, and you know, like the sort of transcending the algorithm kind of thing. It feels like the way to do that is to have a community, not just like numbers, not just views, not just impressions, but like humans who you have a relationship with somehow. How do you imagine those people?
Let me answer that question two different ways. You're touching on something that we talk about a lot. People might have heard Casey Newton get at this in the last time he was on the show. It's pretty easy to get traffic in the world. You can go on TikTok today and get some traffic and get some views. It is really hard to build an audience. And I think a lot of the destruction we see in the media community right now is no one built an audience. They try to get traffic and then they try to sell that traffic and they assume the traffic would last forever. The platforms have no incentives to let you keep having traffic forever, and they absolutely do not have incentive for you to have so much audience that you get leverage over the platforms.
Right.
Such that they might have to pay you a higher rate.
This seems very destructive.
Like
it seems very destructive to the media ecosystem. Like that thing that you just articulated there doesn't seem like a little deal. It seems like a big deal.
I think the defining economic reality of the modern platform media world is that all the platforms realize that an infinite supply of teenage creators are cheaper to deal with than media companies or groups of media individuals or powerful creators. And yeah, I'm curious for your read on sort of the number of YouTubers that you see kind of retiring or taking a step back. It just feels like eventually you hit a point where like there's nothing left here for me. Like it's just me. Like I have to just extract more from myself and put it on this platform every day to succeed. And that stops being valuable. Whereas I think if you were able to build a company or a brand or an institution, at the end of that, you're like, well, I made this.
Yeah.
And maybe I could sell it. Maybe I could just let some other people run it. Maybe it stands for something. Maybe we could shut it down and everyone could talk about how much they missed it. But it's more than you. And I think the platforms are not organized economically to ever allow that to happen because that is expensive. And you can replace individuals all the time.
Yeah, you can. And also, it seems like people have an easier time trusting individuals now than trusting larger brands. So it's sort of...
Oh, I totally disagree with that. Oh. Wait, I think that's like you're platform-pilled. I totally disagree with that. in the biggest, most serious ways that I can possibly think of.
Oh, fuck, yes.
The platforms are designed to create that idea and reinforce it. They want that to be true. They want to say people don't trust brands, they trust people, and that the brands stand for nothing. And that's because when you shove a brand into the same incentive structure as a group of individuals, an infinite supply of teenagers who will work for free, the brands debase themselves. And now the brands are worth nothing. But you know what? Like all the celebrities still want to be on the cover of magazines. Like they want the validation that the big brand, that the institution can provide. And there's a reason for that because the brand stands for more than just an individual opinion, or at least it at its best it does. There are a lot of problems with that. My little blog that people now think of as an institution started out in opposition to big magazines.
Yeah.
Like we were the upstarts. And so I feel that tension all the time. But I think the idea that people trust people more than brands is a creation of the algorithmic media environment. It is not the natural result of people getting smarter or becoming savvier media consumers. That's just the water we're in.
I'm going to stare at my ceiling tonight and think about this because I've never heard anyone even make the case that is...
And I get it. Yeah. The Verge is a collective, right? It's a group of individuals who all make something together. And that means when we go to play on a platform that is organized around someone talking to you, like a TikTok or an Instagram Reels or YouTube Shorts or whatever, it's a different person every time that stands in for this other thing. But if you look at the cover of Vogue this month, it's like all of the Vogue legends, like all the icons, and like Oprah is in the center of that picture, and it's all of these supermodels like around Oprah. And it's like no TikToker can create that moment. Only an institution can create that moment. And that the moment has to provide value back to all of those people, right? You're on the cover of Vogue with all these other people.
So interesting.
Well, where does that come from? That doesn't come from any individual. That comes from Vogue being Vogue.
And Vogue is like making it work kind of in a way that a lot of magazines aren't. But before we get to magazines, because I want to talk about that, this is a good time to ask, Neli, how is The Verge structured?
The Verge is structured.
I love this so much. It's great.
This is tough. I have like a real answer and then a philosophical answer. Are you ready for this?
I'm glad you're ready for the question.
I had to think about this a lot. So we are structured in two ways. There are two organizing principles of Verge. We're structured by topics. We have desks. We have a policy desk. We have a transportation desk. We have a reviews department. That's like topic expertise. Subject matter expertise is one set of organizing principles. Then we're also structured by format, right? So we have like a news team. We have a features team. Reviews, I think, bridges the gap, right? You need to be a subject matter expert in laptops, and then reviews are a particular kind of format. So those are kind of the two ways, and we have teams that kind of address each of those buckets. And they all work together, and we try to make sure our team is constantly moving across formats and desks, because I think we're at our best when the things collide. But the real way that we're organized is by cadence.
What?
And that is actually like a very difficult thing to explain, and you can't actually say that out loud.
What do you mean cadence?
So our news team operates in 20-minute increments. They wake up, the news hits, it goes on the website, they're done, they move on to the next thing.
Okay.
If you want a piece of analysis, or you've got a scoop and you need to build it out, we call those reports. That's like a day or a couple of days. A feature might take a year, or a review might take a week and a half. A video might take 2 months. So we have all these systems that kind of organize those cadences of work, so that they can get the appropriate amount of focus. They can also be finished, because the hardest thing is to like finish what you're working on and be like, okay, we're publishing it now. And so for the news team, everything is always finished. Like, it's finished before it started. Like, the news has occurred, you know? For the features team, it's like, is it done? Like, have we done everything we need to do? Did we set the deadline? Like, did the people respond? Has it gone through legal review? Like, there's all these things that prevent you from being finished. So we try to give things space to be finished on their timeline. And you can really see how, if you just stare at the structure of The Verge long enough, you can see how it's mostly organized around those cadences. And then all the other things just allow sort of like-minded people to work together.
How many people are those people?
I think right now we're about 50. I might be wrong about that, actually. We're hiring, so I don't know.
Sure.
We have some people coming in, so we're growing in fits and starts again, which is exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting. Has the things been good since the redesign? I love the redesign. It was very exciting the first day. I was like, this is just like on the edge of being too weird, where like my brain isn't quite sure what to do, but I like, on the first day, I feel like I know how to use this website. And on the 10th day, I'm like, I know how to use this website.
We definitely changed too much too fast. We dialed it back a little bit, and now we're starting to reintroduce some of those other changes. But the core piece of it, which is, are we making our own website the most valuable place that we work, has been wildly successful, to the point where I'm sometimes like, we're doing too many quick posts. Like, we should make longer things again.
Yeah, nice.
I think that's a good sign, because my number one goal, and this is, remember, this is pre-Elon, my number one goal was, boy, I'd like the reporters who work here to write for us in the text box that pays us money instead of over there in the text box that extracts value.
I should be asking that question of myself. Like, why am I writing the text box that pays money to Elon and Mark and not my
Why
text
do we
box?
All work for free? This is, we want to talk about the platform era in media. Yeah. Why do we all work for free?
Everybody's insisting.
I don't know the answer to that question.
We can't shut up about how our work has value, but then we can't stop giving it away for free.
Yeah. Fuck you, pay me. He typed furiously for free into another box. Like, it's very confusing. And there's a lot of reasons. If you just sit back and think about why, there's a million reasons why. One, the software is nicer to use than most CMSs.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, you just pick one. Name a company that makes a CMS. They're like, is this as fun to use as Twitter? And the answer is no.
Yeah.
Flatly no. Even the one we have now for QuickPost is not as fun to use as Twitter was in its heyday. Will this immediately bring me the dopamine hit of immediate feedback? No.
I just want my little cookie, and my little cookie is people being mean to me.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. Like, will someone just tell, will someone willfully misinterpret this joke? Let's find out. The answer is yes. Is there like a fake revenue source, like a creator fund here that will make me believe that there's, like, of course.
It's possible.
Are there people here who are actually making real money? Right. Which in on YouTube in particular, I think is like YouTube has figured out monetization in a way that feels healthiest and most stable. But it, there's also the haves and have nots. And I think that YouTube loves having the haves because it provides the infinite incentive to the have nots. None of that is true on a regular media company's website. None of that. If you started a WordPress site tomorrow, none of that would be true about your WordPress site. But the first instinct was, let's at least make it easier to publish. Like, let's at least remove the barriers to entry to getting on the website. And then we can do comments, and then we can think about how we can distribute in different ways. So that is working. Like, my team is happier. We did not know that the Twitter thing would happen, but the Twitter thing happened, and our desire to publish in the boxes we controlled went up as a group. And then on top of it, our audience saw that we were having fun.
Yeah.
And once you are having fun on anywhere on the internet, people sort of gravitate to you. And that, so the traffic has gone up.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, Neelai and I discuss how to build an audience in the age of platforms and also how The Verge actually makes money.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. Here's the story of innovation told in five words. Try. Explore. Connect. Pivot. Transform. See what happened there? As soon as Connect entered the story, innovation became achievable. That's why Deloitte works with clients and tech alliances to bring together the people, ideas, and technologies to overcome, solve, and, of course, transform. Connect to what matters for innovation. Start at Deloitte.com/US/innovate.
Support for this show comes from Slack. You're a growing business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is Hank Green, guest host of Decoder, and we're back with The Verge editor-in-chief Neelai Patel about building audiences on the internet and how to turn that into a profitable business. That goes back to the conversation we were having before about audience, and how do you imagine those people? Like, who are they in your head, and how do you feel like you understand them? This is a huge thing for me. I think about it all the time.
Our mission statement is that The Verge is a website about how technology makes people feel. We've kind of narrowed it down. We've had headier ones. We have ones that were designed for advertisers. We've had ones that are like, we're about the future. And like over time, it's like, oh, no, we're just about how this makes you feel. It is a very emotional website about cell phones. And that means we can be expansive. It means we can validate the fact that people are having emotional experiences with their technology. One of the things I say all the time is I can go up to anyone in the world and ask them about their phone and they will tell me a story. Because they have an emotional relationship with this piece of technology that mediates almost all of their other relationships. So there's something they love. There's something they're frustrated about. There's something they wish was better. And you just if you can ask them the right questions, everyone has a story to tell you about their phone. That is a pretty massive set of things to think about. So I think of our audience as people who want to feel those feelings. Like they want to love things. They want to dislike things. They want to be passionate about these objects, these screens that literally mediate almost everything else that happens in our lives. And I think we poke at that pretty hard all the time. And we're never punished for thinking too hard about things. And that to me is like the surest sign that we've at least found a group of people that are stable, that over time can grow, because it's kind of fun to be smart. So I think people, they latch onto that and they evangelize how they feel to their friends, and then the audience grows again and again.
Yeah.
I feel like telling Hank Green it's fun to be smart is like one of the funniest things I could possibly do. Like I truly do not have to convince you of that.
It turns out I do agree with this, and also that it's a great principle from which to build an audience, because of course you get the audience that you build for. You know, you could lots of ways to have lots of different audiences, but it's always better if you're building an audience that you actually like hanging out with. And your Apple Vision Pro coverage, like I'm a guy who doesn't care at all about the Apple Vision Pro. Maybe I should, but I did care about how much y'all cared about it. And like just this sort of like college dorm room, I can't believe we've just spent this much time thinking about the difference between a 6 and a 7 kind of coverage of the Apple Vision Pro. I was like, I don't care about this piece of tech at all, but I care about these doofs. They're great. And I think that you're doing that in a really good way. Once you have that audience and you have this website, how do you turn at The Verge that into money?
We are very precious about how we turn things into money. And I think this has helped us. It has almost entirely helped us. It has hurt us in one particular way, which is we don't make as much money as influencers do. I can talk about why that is.
I just said no to such an expensive brand deal. I was so mad. My assistant was like, it's okay, Hank. I'm like, it's not okay.
Yeah.
I can't believe I'm doing this.
So we say no to all of them. Right. So this is the real hard thing. But the main way we make money is we sell advertising. Senator, we sell ads. And we sell display ads on our website, banners and boxes. We have some ideas on how to make those experiences better. We sell ads on the podcast. I don't read them.
Which I know.
Is not as lucrative as if I did read them.
Yeah. Yeah,
we sell ads. You know, we have YouTube pre-roll. There's sponsored content on the website. It's big disclosures, but there's like advertiser content on our website. So all the ways that media companies make money, except the way that individual creators make a lot of money, which is directly making the brand deals for our talent. So I don't read the podcast ads. Most podcasters just read the ads. We will not stop a YouTube video in the middle and let any of our journalists do the brand read or whatever. We have somebody else who does that, which is Andrew Melnzak. He's great. He's part of our advertising team. He does them. He's very good at them. It's great. But someone else does them. And so that we just maintain and enforce this distance between our work as journalists and what advertisers would like us to say. And I think that is, again, many YouTubers are very, very successful. They make a lot of money. I don't begrudge anybody their businesses. Go be successful. I'm proud of you all. We won't do it, because we are so protective of the journalism that we make. And I worry, honestly, that the audience doesn't care anymore. That we're just like, whatever. Like the audience is like, it just assumes that we're bought and paid for left and right. And we're like, no.
I think they do. I think they do. And I think they know. Like the thing I just said no to, it was because they wanted me to, it was a food product. And they wanted me to be like a person who knows about the world being like, this is good for you. And I was like, that's not my job. That's not who I am. I don't know anything about whether this is good for you or not. And like, also, it's not. Like, it's not. Just food is food. That's not the business that we need to be in, convincing people that, like, one snack food is better than another. Just eat the Doritos, everybody. It's snacks.
Well, so it's really interesting. Like, that, to me, like, what do those brands want? They want people to advocate for them. And they can buy it at scale on a lot of platforms for wild amounts of money. And they can't buy it from us. And the fact that we are not for sale, I think, is... I'm pretty sure this is a bad thing. The fact that we are not for sale is increasingly an anachronism. I think it's our competitive advantage, right? Because I get to yell loudly, we're not for sale, but it is increasingly an anachronism.
Do you get affiliate fees for like reviews?
Yeah. So we have a commerce operation that's sort of over there. And so we review things. That is all editorially independent of what happens on the commerce side of things. And then that team adds affiliate links to buying guides and things like that. And that provides us some revenue, but that is walled off in a meaningful way from like what our reviewers do all day. So if something makes us more money in affiliate sales, our reviewers are not incentivized by that. They barely know it. The one place where it gets a little muddy, and I hope people understand why this is muddy, is deals coverage. Like, our audience wants to know, is this a good deal? Like, here are some deals that are happening. Are they good deals? And then we have to evaluate that. And so the person you want to evaluate in that is closer to editorial than not. You want an objective judgment of like, is this a good deal? But then you get affiliate fees on that. That's where I think it gets the muddiest. But overall, we try to stay as precious and unscathed right. by the commercial aspect of our business as we can.
Yeah. Untainted. Does The Verge make money?
The Verge makes money. We've been around for over a decade. We're the last website on Earth.
Do you think about that a lot? Do you have conversations a lot about like the P&L and et cetera?
We do. I think in my role as editor in chief, it is incumbent on me to make sure that one, we have an audience. Like the audience is happy with us. We're invested in places where we think audience is growing or there's impact. And that we are growing responsibly. So I have a publisher. Her name is Helen Havlak. Helen used to be our engagement editor, and then she was our editorial director. So she was my number one deputy, and I would like go off into the company and have meetings, and then I would come back and ask Helen what to do, and then I would just like go to the meeting and do whatever Helen said. And eventually I was like, this is stupid. You should just be my boss. So Helen is our publisher. Above her is our group publisher, Chris Grant, who's the founder of Polygon. He and I have worked together for years upon years. So the three of us spend a lot of time just thinking about our business and like where we're investing and how it works. But the split is that I'm in charge of editorial and creative, and Helen is in charge of our business.
It's a website that makes money. Amazing.
I think fundamentally, like the idea that we have a website that makes money is weird. Like it is
revolutionary.
But also I will say we operate inside of a company called Vox Media that also makes money and like is also in the turmoil of the digital media business. But overall, compared to sort of its peers, has managed to weather the storm. And a huge part of that is the company is founded on community and is founded on product, like building web products. And that is resilient.
So you are a busy guy. What do you do? You host several podcasts. You just launched
episode of Decoder. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got that going on. You got a lot of people to manage. You're a dad. You got many, many things. I have a classic Decoder question, but in two parts for you. How do you make decisions at The Verge, but also how do you make decisions at Nilay Patel?
I like really workshopped this answer. And the answer is panic. Pure panic.
I use that too. That's one of my favorite ways.
Yeah. I am optimized around speed. That fundamentally, the crisper you are in making a decision, the faster that decision can be proven to be wrong. And then you know a lot. So you get to remake the decision. There's one thing that makes that different for me than I think other people in other kinds of jobs. There's a bunch of decisions we make as an organization every single day, minute to minute, that don't get to be unmade. We publish a news story and it's wrong. We don't get to unmake that decision. We have to issue a correction and put it at the bottom of the story. We write a headline. It's really not great for us to write and rewrite headlines. So there's a whole bunch of instinct and taste and hard-fought experience just about sort of making the product we make every day that we still have to do it really fast, right? The core value of a newsroom, especially news on like ours, is speed. So we still have to win every day, all the time, but we have to be fast. But next to that, and so I just want to bracket that set of like editorial decision-making because that is a group product. Like a lot of us make those decisions all together all the time, and we are very aware of the stakes of getting some of that stuff wrong. But then there's like everything else. Like, should we spend money and going on this thing? It's like, yeah, we should. Let's go. Let's like see what happens. Like, get a story out of it. How many podcasts am I going to do today? Like, fine. Like, there's only so many I can do.
Because
you've
got to be in a lot of meetings, but you also have to be in a lot of podcasts, which are like meetings, but hopefully more fun.
I wish more of my meetings were like podcasts. Like, everyone like desperately trying to be a little bit more entertaining than they usually are.
Yeah.
It would be great. I actually am really bad at context switching. So a big part of my decision-making process is to stack up like modes of operation. So I'll be in meeting mode for 4 hours. I need an hour basically to like turn that off and go into individual contributor podcast host mode. And so I really try to make like, for lack of a better word, like talent moments where it's I have to be on and performing for an audience, and then manager moments where I have to like, you know, navigate meeting world and like make a bunch of decisions and like evaluate trade-offs. Like all of that is a different part of my brain. And I try to not switch between those modes very often. I try to stay really focused. But fundamentally, when you ask me like how I make decisions, it's usually I know the stakes of any decision that we're making because we've been running The Verge for a very long time. And the people around me know the stakes of most of our decisions. And then it's, can we make the decision quickly? And importantly, can that decision stay made? Because it's, we can make a decision and then it has to like bounce somewhere else and someone else has to like think about it. And that's when a decision gets unmade and that's when the chaos sets in.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But when you're figuring out how to prioritize your own time, when somebody says it'd be better for The Verge if Decoder had a second episode a week, how do you say, yeah, that one, yes, is worth more of my time being spent on this, but not some other of the many other cool things you could be doing that would generate revenue and also be exciting for you?
Yeah. The second episode of Decoder, it's weird when you do a podcast. Podcasts are forever projects. They don't end unless you are telling a tidy story, right? You just make one a week for the rest of your life.
It's like YouTube. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's like they're just forever projects. So I have always, with Decoder in the back of my head, had one end state, which is we should do enough of these and ask the same questions enough times so that we can do a book. Right. And then we can like put together a book that's like helpful, that it's full of advice about how companies work and
print.
How decisions are made. It's print again. And then like that would be like a useful artifact of the time we all spent making the show. And we kind of got to a place where we're starting to talk about that. I don't know if we're going to do anything with it, but we are able to at least talk about it, which is fascinating. And then we're like, oh, there's more Decoder we can make now that we've achieved the goal of like the show exists. It has a format. There are some questions we ask people. People want to be on the show. When you start a new podcast, you have to basically beg people to be on it. Now we have a lot of incoming, which is really useful and good, and I hope it continues, although there's still people we want to go get, so we still go ask. But the first version of Decoder is sort of running itself. And then it's like, oh, but there's other stuff we want to talk about that does not lend itself to an hour-long interview with a CEO. There's lots of stuff that is happening in this world that we can talk about and explain that it's hard. It's actually hard to find a not self-interested CEO to talk about. Like AI and copyright law, I can go talk to a lot of CEOs. They are all self-interested. We actually want to take a step back and help people understand that.
Talk to Robert Kinsel about it. I'm sure he'll have a really diverse, nuanced perspective.
Yeah. I'm sure Sam Altman has a strong point of view on whether AI and copyright law are compatible.
Yeah.
We just were like, the stories we want to do are a little more expansive than this box. We can do a shorter one. We can figure out how to make that efficient. And that will actually let us put more Verge reporters on the show. It'll let us put more friends of the show on the show. And it'll let us, when we do our audience surveys, the audience is like, we like it when Neil explains things. It's like actual feedback we get. So let us deliver some more of what the audience wants. And that is, to me, a good use of my time because it serves my team. It lets my team come address the audience on the show, and it serves the audience. The most useful advice I've ever been given about time management was from Satya Nadella, CEO of Microsoft. I was in the back of a car with him one time. We were going from one thing to another, and he was telling me about like all the things he'd done that day. Like he'd gone for a run. He went to an investor meeting. We were doing this interview. He was going to open a story. He was going to have it. And I was like, what? How do you do all these things? And he looked at me very seriously, and he said, it's your time. You have to be selfish about it. And I was like, oh, shit. Like the master of the universe just like told me to have better time management. And I hold on to that.
Wow.
Like very dearly. Like you can only do the things you only have so much time. You can only do the things you really want to do. And all the other stuff is kind of noisy. And if it's important, it'll come back around.
We got to take a quick break. We'll be back to discuss the big shifts Neelai is seeing on the web, The Verge's AI policy, and what he thinks is exciting about the Fediverse.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Eurovision is here. This year's contest gets underway this week in Malmö, Sweden. But this year's contest comes with a dose of controversy. I'll give you one guess as to what people are mad about. Yes, correct. It's that.
Organisers of the Eurovision Song Contest say they are assessing whether Israel's entry breaks the rules on political neutrality.
I think it's a shame. I think there is no way that Israel should be able to participate.
Pro-Palestinian protesters are taking to the Swedish streets. More than 1,000 Swedish artists, including Robin, have called for an Israel ban. Some European politicians are joining them. Charlie Harding from Switched On Pop joins us this week on Today Explained to help us figure out if Europe can sing its way out of this situation.
This week on The Pitch, we're breaking form and introducing a new segment on our show called The Exit. You had your first exit at 18 years old, your second at 24. And then 6 months later, you start another company. This one's called Shipt.
The company just exploded overnight.
And then you realize, all right, we need more money. So you went out to Sand Hill Road.
I'm not a West Coast type. I didn't have feel for the game, but I figured it out really fast.
What did you think when you threw out the number?
It is very easy to get distracted and excited and thinking about what you're going to do with your millions. I ran the company out of money. I know my CFO and everybody was thinking, this is nuts.
Oh, Shipt. Do you have any regrets about Shipt? How Bill Smith, a high school dropout from Birmingham, Alabama, started, scaled, and sold his startup for $550 million in 3 years. That's this week. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're back talking with The Verge editor-in-chief Neil Patel about the state of the web and whether I should go all in on the Fediverse.
It definitely feels like this is a time when everything is a big mess. So we've got sudden layoffs at all kinds of newspapers. Google seems to be worse than it used to be. AI is maybe going to take over from search someday. YouTube isn't a hegemon anymore. Twittered. The Fediverse might happen. I think it's like exciting. Do you think that all of this like space is going to create like new sunlight reaching ground and like new things will happen? And what do you think those new things might be?
I do. What I worry about is that there's not a ton of random money sitting around.
there were at certain times. Yeah.
There have been in other times of the internet. But
yeah.
Let me make the case for the green shoots. We were founded in a particular moment where there was a confluence of two things. One, you might remember the millennial media moment was big. Millennials killed things left and right. They showed up. They entered the workforce. I'm like on the tail end of Gen X, so I myself think of myself as Gen X, but yeah, 1 year younger than me, you're a millennial. Sorry, everybody.
Yeah. I think we're exactly the same age. Yeah.
Yeah. But you remember that. Millennials are killing everything. Like Olive Gardens burned to the ground across America. Yep. Like nothing was safe.
What a loss.
Because their habits were different. It was a huge generational shift. New people were entering the workforce. They were young. They were going to do something different than their parents were going to do. And you could see, okay, a bunch of money is moving because these people have different tastes. At the same time, that was when the mobile phone had arrived, the smartphone had arrived. You're in the first flush of like the LTE era of the internet, basically. And so you have a new audience with new habits in a new distribution format, right? And that distribution format really looked like social networks. And you just saw a bunch of media companies spring up to meet that moment and a bunch of other companies spring up to meet that moment. And so the idea that you have an audience shift and a technology shift is very powerful. I think we see that again right now. Like very clearly I see that right now. You have a Gen Z audience. You have a millennial audience that is in a Gen X audience and a boomer audience is pretty sick of the internet as it is today.
Yep.
Like they're over it. Like these platforms, to borrow the phrase from Cory Doctorow, is being inshittified, like left and right. People are looking for something else. And then you have Gen Z, which is actually another new generation, has habits yet to form. And then I think you do see some of these technology shifts elsewhere. I do think you see some of the action around the Fediverse and decentralized social networks and the collapse of Twitter. And there's just opportunity to build new kinds of products for audiences that are looking for something new or haven't yet formed their habits. And that is just a very powerful moment that reminds me of the moment that we were founded in. Now, is there a bunch of VC money floating around to make that bet again?
Yeah, maybe there's sunlight, but there's no fertilizer.
Yeah, and to be fair, the VC money that started the BuzzFeeds and the other, it's not like they had great returns. Like it was a great bet. Like we didn't create a bunch of lasting millennial media institutions. We might have created but one or two, and I might accidentally run one of them, and that's weird. Like I don't think that should be the case, right? Like that should not. That's not right.
Yeah, I think you're better at strategy than you think you are, or than you're willing to take credit for.
Like, we are just stubborn about being about one thing. Right. That is our only secret. We care a lot. We work really hard. Those are basics. But then we have been very stubborn that like The Verge has an identity and we're not going to like get moved off the ball too much. It's the same for every YouTuber who's great. The algorithm comes and goes and buffets people in different directions. But the ones who have had lasting success on any platform are the ones who are pretty true to themselves. And that, I think, is just a universal media lesson.
Does The Verge have an AI policy?
I'm the only person I know who has published AI written copy on the website.
Oh.
Everyone refuses to be outraged about it. This thing should go viral because the editor-in-chief of The Verge published a post half written by AI. And if I could just get the outrage viral traffic, we'd be doing the next episode of this on a boat, Hank.
Get mad.
Yeah. You won't get mad. It's I wrote an article that said everyone should just buy a Brother laser printer. And then to try to game Google, I let ChatGPT like fill out the back half of the thing with like filler text. Google was not very happy about it. We did sell a lot of printers. That's a true.
Interesting.
The commerce team told me we moved a bunch of printers that day.
Wow.
It briefly ranked very highly in Google, which they were equally not happy about. But yeah, we don't.
We're in a mess. This is a mess, man. the web is in trouble.
It's real bad.
You got to have fun
while it burns down. So that was my fun.
It costs 50
It was an art
cents.
Project of a printer post.
If it costs 50 cents to fill the entire web up with crap.
Yeah.
The entire web will be filled with crap. Like, I am glad I'm not Google right now.
They this seem troubled. Mess. But yeah, so that's the only AI copy that's been on our site so far. I think our policy, straightforwardly, is we don't lie to people.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we're never – we actually, because of the phones we reviewed and the things we've done, we've certainly now published photos that have been edited by AI just to show people. Like, look at this photo edited by AI.
Yeah.
I'm sure over time there will be more elements of that stuff, but our policy very succinctly is like, do not lie to people. So
yeah, if you're doing something, tell the people that you're doing it.
And I think our audience wants us to push the boundary and just like just showing what the tools can do. But we are very, we're very precious. We're going to disclose everything. Yeah. And like largely what we sell here is people. Like this is where the people are and we're going to stay pretty focused on that.
So the Fediverse excites me because I don't understand it. I understand the technology idea that like my posts can be seen on different platforms because they're all part of a standard protocol and that like my follower graph can follow me and like my bio can populate on other places. But I don't know what it means. Like I don't know what gets created in that space. And I don't think anybody does. I think like if you change social media in this way, what happens? A lot of people seem to be like, if you change it in this way, things will get better. But I also remember feeling that way about everything so far that like, I remember back when, Twitter was going to save the world and like social media was going to bring us all together. Can you convince me that the Fediverse will be better if it actually happens?
I can try. I don't know that I can make the case that it will be 100% better. I can make...
Well, no.
Yeah.
1% better.
I can make a 1% better case.
Not
That's
worse.
Easy. I got, yeah. That one's okay. Easy. I got 1%. Okay. So the real answer is between 1 and 100, but I can do 1. Okay. So, there's this phrase that people in media who think about media like say all the time, content is king, right? Everyone people like pop out of dark corners to say this to you. If you ever hint that content isn't king, someone's like, no, content is king. And it's just this like... mantra. Like people just say it. Like people, the audience will go wherever the content is, no matter what. And you kind of take one step back and you're like, well, distribution is really important. Yeah. And in fact, the lesson of the internet is that the distribution has an outsized impact on what content gets made.
Yeah. And discovery. I don't really know the difference between discovery and distribution, but I think like they may now be the same thing.
Oh yeah, I completely agree. So the YouTube algorithm wants something. And YouTubers deliver that to the algorithm. I'll give you another example that I think about all the time. I love the band New Order. The 12-inch single, when they made it possible to make vinyl records that were 12 inches with one song on them, New Order was like, here's Blue Monday. We made it for you. It's very long because they just – the distribution medium, like the format literally allowed them to make that song. YouTube is like that. All these platforms are like that in some way. YouTube, depending on how you think about it, to get a second pre-roll slot on a YouTube video, it has to be so long. And YouTube will be like, no, that's not how it works. But like every YouTuber is like, yeah, it has to be so long. Like, and there's a push and pull between what the platform says about itself and what the people who create for the platform.
Suddenly all my videos are going to be 8 minutes long.
Right. And YouTube will probably listen to this and tell one of us that that's not right. But it's like YouTubers like, yeah, it's 8 minutes long. Like, there's a number and it gets what it wants. And that recommendation algorithm is the distribution for people for a lot. And they push things into boxes. And that means I think the content isn't king on the internet. Like the distribution actually just creates the work or creates the pressures that forces all the work to be the same. And I think over time, that's what drives the audiences away.
Hmm.
Right? So that there's a real change in how these platforms work where over time they just become more and more the same thing. And the creators become more and more the same. And that's a little exhausting. And every place where you see open distribution, you see a huge variety of creators and content. Podcasts have basically open distribution, like RSS feeds. Podcasts are distributed on RSS feeds. That means people kind of own their distribution. There's a vast array of podcast creators. There's a vast array of podcast formats. They don't all sound like the beginning of YouTube videos or whatever. And I hate to keep picking on YouTube. It's just you can pick any algorithmic platform and it's the same. Like TikTokers are more the same than different, right? Podcasters are more different than the same. The web is distributed largely, you know, through websites and through RSS. There's a huge variety of websites and the way websites look. But then you see the algorithmic search pressure push web design kind of all into the same box. Newsletters distributed via email, open distribution. The newsletter economy is full of a huge variety of creators doing a huge variety of things. They're more different than the same. So all I see with the Fediverse is, oh, this is going to open social distribution up a little bit. It's going to allow us to control our distribution networks. It's going to say, I'm not on Twitter, but people on Twitter can follow my website. And I can go promote that follow anywhere I want in different ways and build an audience outside of the pressures of the algorithm. To me, just that ability to try is 1% better.
That's exciting, actually. Should I be a Fediverse person? Should I be on the Fediverse somehow? What should I do there?
I think you should poke at it.
Okay.
I think you should start a Mastodon account and you can follow a PixelFed account on it. And you're like, that's weird. I followed this account from the service that looks like Instagram.
It's like a driverless car. It's like a car that's driving itself without a person in the front. It's just weird. It's strange.
Yeah. And they're like, well, how would I reshape society around this? You're like, I don't know. Many, many questions to be answered along the way. But just that first action, like I am on a website that looks like Instagram. And I can follow a creator that posts something that looks like tweets on this thing. And I can open yet another app and log into both of them. And it will just like show me everything. It is mind expanding in one particular kind of way because the commercial internet has never allowed you to do these things. Blue Sky, which is a different kind of decentralized service, they just opened up. Anybody can go sign up for it now. They have their own decentralization protocol called the AT protocol. Their idea is that there should be a marketplace for algorithms. That you can show up, you can look at the fire hose of content, you can say, I'm going to buy an algorithm that shows me only posts about Santa Claus, and it's going to go do the work for you. That's a huge idea that is completely unproven, but it's more exciting than, okay, here's another billionaire who's going to prattle on about free speech and then eventually like betray you. If you're me and you run a big website and you are thinking like, how can I redistribute this website? Like, how can I reach people more directly? My brain is like lit up. Like you should be able to follow me at theverge.com and see all my quick posts in your Threads account when Threads federates. That's a big deal, like a really big deal, especially if we can find ways to monetize that in a way that feels good. That's a really big deal.
How would you monetize it?
We got to invent some stuff. I have a very enlightened CEO, Jim Benkoff, and he's allowing me to poke at some ideas about those things, like what does new distribution look like in the Fediverse? And then our company has like a giant sports property, and you know what hasn't left yet is sports Twitter. So I'm going to poke at it with The Verge, and we're like lightly exploring it. But I think there's opportunity there to build new kinds of media products that is like really exciting. And like you just have to do the first thing, which is you have to be on one server and follow someone on another server and be like, oh, that worked. And then your brain starts exploding.
I don't. Yeah. But my brain hasn't exploded with a monetization idea yet. I'm very curious about that. So I'll just watch you do it, I guess.
Well, and the thing is, like, the dollars are leaving Twitter, right? So
yeah,
there's just a pool of money that used to be getting spent on Twitter that who knows where it's going to go.
Right.
And if you can just make it kind of like easier and safer and less mm-hmm. Nazi filled to spend money on our website, like maybe there's something there. We have to actually build it. You know, we did one test of, you know, we have QuickPost. We did one test where we sold a QuickPost as an ad. It was very manual. They sold it to Apple, which is really cool and like neat, you know, and Apple did an experiment. They bought a new kind of ad with us. Great. That's not my side of the house, but it was a test and everybody liked it. Right. Like our audience was like, oh, this is a better ad than the other kinds of ads.
Everyone clapped.
Yeah. It's like, oh, we invented a new ad thing that like feels good in this place.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, there's you can just like put some pieces together and be like, oh, this makes sense to me. And I'd rather be in the sort of like market competition side of things than like the spin the wheel of what billionaire do you trust today.
In my history of making stuff on the internet, it has seemed like every time a company has said, hello, we'd like you to make fewer decisions and we will make the decisions for you, the people say, yes, give me that. And I don't like this. but I wonder if we will look back and think like, ah, that was a weird moment in history. Or if this is like a path that we are on and we will just keep on heading down it until no one ever makes any content decisions at all, except for whether, I mean, TikTok is almost already all the way like this, except for whether to keep watching and all that. So the only data that the platform needs to continue to serve you things that will keep you infinitely satiated.
One very trite saying that I repeat a lot is that data can only tell you about the past.
Okay.
It is a perfect window into the past. It is an absolutely useless view into the future. Maybe it will help you make a smarter bet, but it will not tell you what is going to happen in the future, especially when it comes to people on the internet. Like, it just won't. And especially when it comes to art and creativity, it absolutely is useless in that case. Like the famous William Goldman saying is the secret truth of Hollywood is like no one knows what they're doing. It's true. It's like there's a reason it's a saying. There's a reason it's a cliche. I'm not sure if that's 100% the saying, but it's close enough. no one knows what they're doing. See, I don't even know what I'm doing. I think the idea that you can like algorithmically perfect a feed by just looking at all the data will actually drive people to an intense amount of boredom and they'll just go try something else. I also think young people reflexively and to their great credit just reject everything their parents did. They just throw it out the window and then they do it again 10 years later and pretend they invented it, which is great and I think a very important cycle of creativity. But I think that danger is overblown because it requires a level of mathematical certainty that is not reflected anywhere in reality.
Okay. With that in mind, I want to read you something that you said on Threads.
Oh, no.
Which is amazing. It's good. You are confirming yourself. Another reason we're mourning these magazines, this is about Sports Illustrated being shut down, is because the media that has replaced them is clout-chasing algorithmic garbage, not anything that has aspirations of being bigger than whatever metrics a platform gives them. Of course, there is a new Sports Illustrated. It's Barstool Sports. It is weightless and empty and the best-case scenario for a media company built to succeed on platforms. Firstly, goddamn boy.
Oh boy. Wow.
Call the burn unit. Second, though, this is going to maybe feel like it comes out of left field. You're talking about moving, like, let's have websites. Let's have distributed. Let's not have platforms. This feels a little bit like one step away from saying maybe print has a future and maybe like, it could be something new again. Do you think print could be something new again?
Maybe. I work at a company that runs a legendary print magazine in New York Magazine. We've published Verge stories in collaboration with New York and had them on the cover of that magazine. And boy, does that make everybody excited. Boy, is that just the coolest feeling in the world. And, you know,
yeah,
it is not a normal media company where the weirdo tech website gets to go talk to the legendary print magazine and say, hey, do you want to work together on a big story? And by the way, we'd love to put it on a cover. And the legendary print magazine is like, dope. Like, let's run. And so all of my credit to David Haskell and the people at New York who are like open to this idea. Like, that is not – that is an impossibility almost everywhere else, even for two print magazines to collaborate like that. For us to do it is amazing, and like, I love the company I work at. But it's really cool when it happens. It's just – it's the coolest when it happens. And so I do think there's some amount of – people would like to buy atoms, not just bits, you know? And the atoms are really meaningful to them. So there's – I don't know what kind of future that is. I don't know that we're going to do a print magazine anytime soon. But like, what does that represent? It represents, well, somebody cared enough to print this picture and like mail a piece of paper to everybody around. And the care is really validating for the people who get to be on the covers or whatever. And that validation is really important. That's not really what I was getting at in that Threads post, though. What I was getting at there is...
No, I know. It just made me think about it.
Yeah.
It made me think about it. But yeah, go hit me.
What I was getting at there is Sports Illustrated, its aspiration was to be a chronicle of culture, right? Yeah. Was, right? Like the great magazines, the great print magazines, the great media brands, they had aspirations that were bigger than their revenue, that were bigger than their view counts. It was, did we make an impact? Did we move the culture? Is this the thing everybody's talking about? Is this the magazine cover that maybe it sold the most on the newsstands, but it was the most striking and evocative? I judge the ASME Awards, the National Magazine Awards, and you know the people in those rooms, they still talk about impact. They still talk about what makes a great magazine, and that's like an art form that is discussed. I think that's inspiring, right? Like people really care about like packaging and design and all this stuff. Barstool Sports, whatever you want to think about Barstool Sports, it has an editorial point of view. It absolutely does. It has a main character every single day. Absolutely does. But it is defined by its metrics. Its aspiration is to have the most views. Its aspiration as an organization is to get the most traffic. And they think that way. You can see it comes through in the work they make because nothing is designed to be so big that it overcomes the view count. And I think that's empty. I think that's why people are sad that something like Sports Illustrated that used to stand for all that stuff is in decline, and it feels like there's no replacement. There should be a replacement. Media brands should die over time. There should be new ones. I think that's a healthy cycle. But all the new ones are either individual creators who are getting burned out by the dozen, or they are media brands that are designed mostly to be optimized for platform distribution and never stand for anything much bigger. That effort and that care is actually what ends up differentiating you in any sort of non-commoditized market, and the platforms are about commoditization. And that maybe that is more so the tension than individuals versus brands. But when you have a brand, you try to differentiate. And our company, at least in its history, has tried to differentiate on quality, which is more expensive.
Yeah. Yep.
We're going to be fine. We're going to save the media with blog posts. It's going to be great.
You're going to save the media with blog posts with the last website on Earth. And I keep saying weird things and putting them on stickers that I could put on things.
I've given – those stickers have ended up on some very powerful laptops, which is very funny to me.
Well, I'm very impressed by what y'all are doing at The Verge, and I'm honored – frankly, that you gave me the opportunity to be a one-time host so that you could be interviewed.
I'm very worried that I'm not fired, by the way. I want to be very clear. The chances of me being fired are very high, and this might be the last thing I ever do.
All right. Well, in that case, it'll go down in history.
Yeah, you want to raise the stakes right at the end of the podcast.
Yeah. Neil Patel, thank you for being on Decoder.
Thank you for agreeing to this ridiculous idea. I appreciate it.
I'd like to thank Neilai for taking the time to speak with me and for letting me take the reins of Decoder for a moment. And thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it and it wasn't too weird. It was a lot of fun for me. If you're looking for more of what I'm up to, you can find me by searching Hank Green on the internet. I'm on Threads fairly actively at Hank Green. Also, Apparently, all of the Verge people are there now and a bunch of tech reporters, and that's mostly why I'm there. So if Meta wants to thank anyone, they're the ones making it happen over there, as far as I'm concerned. My YouTube channel that I had with my brother is at Vlogbrothers on YouTube. We have a podcast called Dear Hank and John. And if you want to hear my science trivia game show podcast, that's called SciShow Tangent. You can listen to that wherever there are podcasts. If you have big ideas on what the Decoder team should cover or who they should have on the show, they would love your feedback. You can email them at decoder@theverge.com. They really do read every email. Or you can hit up Neil and I on Threads. He's at reckless1280. They also have a TikTok. You can check it out at DecoderPod. If you like Decoder, please share this with your friends and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you really love the show, you can give that 5-star review. I give it a 5-star review. Maybe I didn't yet. Let's do it right now. You and me. Let's pop open that app and give it a 5-star review. Are you doing it? I'm doing it right now. Here I go. It's open. And I click on those three little dots on Spotify and click on Rate Show. And there, I'm doing it. 5 stars. 5 stars for Decoder. Decoder is a production of The Verge and is part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today's episode is produced by Kate Cox and Nick Statt and was edited by Callie Wright. Thank you to all of them for helping me through the process. The Decoder music is, of course, by Breakmaster Cylinder. See you next time.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot, because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.